So you just hit
record
right?
Whenever. That's it. Good. So we're going. So you want me to do a quick intro just now? How long? How many seconds do you want it to be?
15-20 seconds.
Okay. And the call to action is watch my interview at, or is it some?
Just introduce yourself, and then you say, "I did an interview with Eventor," and you can check out their blog post on eventor.app.
Okay.
Dot app.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me record this first just now, and that way it's done. Okay. Hey there, it's James Taylor here, keynote speaker on business creativity, innovation, and artificial intelligence. I just did an interview for Eventor, and you're going to find that interview at Eventor app. So head over to there just now.
That was perfect.
Is that okay?
Yeah, perfect.
Cool.
Thank you very much. Cool. So should we jump right into
it? Let's go for it.
Perfect. So the first question is, I would like you to walk me through this, like the step-by-step process that you went through to get where you are today. So you started off as a manager of high profile rock stars, right? And why you decided to become an international keynote speaker.
Yeah. So when I left school, I actually became a professional musician first, a drummer, professional jazz drummer. And for the first 2 years or so, that's really what I was doing. I was traveling all around the world playing drums. But I always was fascinated by the business side of things. And very quickly, I started being asked to organize events, club nights, for example. And then I got asked to start managing other artists. And then one thing led to another. And I was then asked to manage a number of kind of more high profile artists. So I started managing bands like Deacon Blue, pop band, Ricky Ross, who's the songwriter from that band. And then from there, I suddenly realized one day, well, this is all great, managing artists and putting tours together, but you don't really have any intellectual property that you're creating. There's not, you know, once the artists walk out the door, then that's it done. So myself, my wife, Alison, we then decided to start a record label, which actually is two record labels, and a music publishing company. And we had a lot of success with that as well. Records getting released all over the world, and our publishing being used on everything from Japanese soap operas to TV ads to children's TV shows. But then we could also start to see what was going on with things like the arrival of Napster, which happened around 1999, 2000, I would say. And I could see the music industry, certainly the record industry, was going to change dramatically. So what we started to do was to pivot, like any good startup, start to pivot and think about what we wanted to do next. And an opportunity came up for me to move to California and to work in online education. And I was always really passionate about education in one form or the other. And also I was always very interested about online, online marketing. And this combination of online education was, that's cool. I want to learn about that. So there was a gentleman there, he was starting a company, and he asked me to come on board to help them grow this company in California. And what we were doing is we were starting online music schools. And we started, over the space of the next 3 years, we launched 30 online music schools. And we worked with Grammy award-winning music artists, and we would help them create their online schools, create all the content, and then launch it like a subscription-based. So imagine like a Netflix for music lessons was the best way of describing it. And then I was getting asked to speak more and more at conferences around online, around education, around marketing, technology, and creativity. And I was finding I was enjoying that so much that I thought maybe actually that's something that I want to do. I want to, you know, speak and just really spend a lot of my time doing kind of what I was doing before, which was traveling around the world, but not traveling around the world as a musician or as a manager of artists, but traveling around the world as a speaker. And then that's basically what I do today. So I get to, in the past 90 days, I've spoken in 19 countries around the world, and I speak to everyone from governments of countries to large corporate organizations, multinationals to associations in all different types of industries. And I speak primarily on business creativity, innovation, and artificial intelligence. So that's how I arrived at where I am today.
Wow, that sounds amazing. And what are you working on right now, and what are your goals in the future?
At the moment, what we're working on is really amplifying the message that we're putting out there around creativity, or this idea of super creativity, which super creativity is how humans can augment their creativity with exponential technologies like AI, like machine learning. So at the moment, what we're doing is we're creating a series of courses and different products and programs in order to help get that message out there. You know, my big goal, my big mission really, is to unlock the creative potential in 1 billion people, 1 billion. That's a big number. And I can't do that by going and just speaking on stages, as much as I love speaking on stages. So I have to use online, social media, other things in order to be able to get those ideas out there. And that's what I'm doing at the moment, working with a lot of folks in South America, in Asia, in the Middle East now, in order to take my ideas around super creativity and creativity and take that to the masses, to large numbers of people.
That sounds very interesting. So when you changed from being like a managing high-profile rock stars to becoming an international keynote speaker, that was probably a really big adjustment. But you said you already started being a speaker, but what would your advice be for like handling criticism, and also on what advice can you give to people on following their passion? Because a lot of people are scared to actually change their careers and try something new like you did. What advice can you give them?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, getting up on stage, like last week I was speaking at an event of 700 people at this event, and I get up on stage and I speak there. And if you think about it from an evolutionary standpoint, our brains, we've been kind of hardwired. The idea of getting up, let's imagine the Serengeti plains of Africa. You get up, you've got nothing to defend yourself. There's nothing there. It's open, wide space. There's nowhere to hide. It's just you. So the fight or flight part of your brain is very naturally wanting just to get off of that stage, not even going that stage in the first place. So I think that, you know, the first part is the way I always think about getting over that is just getting to a place where you're really passionate about your topic and you just want to share it. And initially, you might start just getting up there in front of 20 people and sharing the idea. And then gradually over time, those numbers might increase until you're speaking to thousands of people. But I still think it starts with the same place. Having something that you're passionate about and you want to, a message that you want to share with the world. And sometimes when I work with speakers, the first thing we have to do is to find what that message is. And I mean, you did that, you know, with the event you and I have worked on together with the TEDx, is finding what is that idea that's worth spreading. And I think everyone, you know, they say everyone has a book in them. I think everyone has a great speech in them. It's just about finding that core message. And then once you've kind of identified, well, what do I want to say? Then it's really around the mechanics in terms of your stage skills, how you present, how you craft a great speech or a keynote, and then how you get booked to speak on stages. So that's the bit. And actually, I have a whole program at speakersyou.com where I actually train speakers on how to go and build an international speaking career. And many of them are working in very successful corporate jobs, but they feel that they've got to a point in their life where they want to make a change. And they want to, that could be because they just want the lifestyle change. They want to be traveling around the world and having fun and having adventures. Or they're really passionate about a particular cause. It could be an environmental causes or diversity, or around something around motivation or spirituality, and they want to get out there and share it. So once they identify that, then we kind of help them. I help them basically find how to get it up into the stages, because I think we are living at a time just now, especially with online. I heard a stat the other day, in the next 3 years, another 3 billion people will be coming online for the very first time. So that's 3 billion people who have never bought, sold, or uploaded anything online before. I think that's a huge opportunity for entrepreneurs, for speakers, for teachers, for trainers. So you have to ask what message do you want to be able to share with that world. And once you kind of identify, you know, the roughly what that message is going to be about, then it's about crafting it and then getting out into the world.
And do you also have any advice or tips on how you can find what you want to share or your passion?
So the I always think it's a bit like a Venn diagram. There's those things which you know a lot about, those things which you're passionate, really passionate about, and those things that people are willing to pay you money for. And somewhere in the middle there is a place. So for example, you might know a lot about something, but you know, you're not that passionate about, but people might pay you money for it, but you're not that passionate about sharing it. Other times you have something which, you know, people want to, you know, you're really passionate about and people would pay you money for, but you don't have any knowledge about it at this time. So it's about filling in those blanks. So really it's about those overlapping areas around your passion, around having some expertise around an area, and then having someone that's going to pay you to go and share that message on a stage.
Perfect. Thank you for that answer. Now moving on to, we're going into like advice that you can give to entrepreneurs, because I saw that you won the Icon of the Year award by the United Nations Global Entrepreneur Council. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Is there any advice you can give to entrepreneurs in regard to the upcoming creativity crisis? How should they deal with what's about to hit us?
I think just now is a phenomenal time to be an entrepreneur for a number of reasons. One is one I could already mention about these new customers coming online for the first time and coming into the market for the first time. But another one is around the technological changes that are going on with things like AI and machine learning. And the way I think about it just now is if you think about when electricity was first invented. Now, when electricity was first invented, sure, the electricity companies made a lot of money. But think about all the companies and the products and the services that were created on the back of electricity in one way or the other. And I think where we're at just now is with things like we hear about AI and machine learning and robotics, how that's going to change our jobs and it's going to take away a lot of jobs and going to create a lot of new ones. But I think now we're in this time of implementation. So regardless of what you do, let's say if you're a lawyer, I would always be thinking, if now, what if I took my legal background, my knowledge there, and what about if I added AI to it? What would that look like? In fact, the other day, they just launched a legal firm. There's three partners in that firm, a gentleman called Robert Huang. And Robert, the firm is called Robot, Robot, and Huang. Three partners in the firm, he is the only human partner. The other two partners are AIs. One AI specializes in legal mergers and acquisitions. The other specializes in litigation. So this is a new type of legal firm, which is half human, half AI, that are working together. So that's in the world of AI. But let's say, imagine you're a designer, a product designer. You have now a thing called generative design, where you can combine your human creativity with technologies like AI, like 3D printing, to do very interesting things as well. Or let's imagine you're in the world of finance. Huge opportunities in finance for combining human creativity, strategic thinking, critical thinking with the processing power of machines and machine learning. So I think as an entrepreneur, the first thing I would be doing is whatever your domain of expertise is, I would be looking to see how could I augment what I do just now with technology like AI. And you're dealing in virgin land here. This is like the Wild West a little bit, but I think there's massive opportunities to make some pretty huge transformations.
And how do you think that the job market will look in, say, 10 years? Like, do you think that people will be prepared to the change for the change, or how can we prepare for a change? Because there are still so many companies who don't think that the technology is advanced enough, and they don't really use it enough. There are still, say, a lot of maybe elder people who are still in the really high positions in companies, and they don't realize how much potential the technologies have. So how do you think?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the University of Oxford estimates nearly 50% of jobs could disappear over the next few years because of technologies like AI. 85% of jobs will be done in, I think, 2030, haven't even been invented yet. So we're going to see these massive changes that are going on in terms of how an individual or an entrepreneur can prepare for that, or a business can prepare for that. I think you have to come to peace with the idea you either have to disrupt or you have to be disrupted. That's the option that you have. You're going to get a lot of jobs that will they're just going to disappear because the machines will do them better, and that's a percentage of the jobs. But I actually think what people should be almost more worried about are those competitors that are coming along. There might be completely new entrants into a market who will use some of these technologies and will just out-innovate you, and they're going to take your jobs. So it's not necessarily a machine is going to take your job, but another company is going to take all that business because they just can use these technologies better and they understand them better and they can combine them with their human creativity and innovativeness. So if I was, as an individual just now, I would be definitely investing in, and this isn't just me saying this, this is based upon World Economic Forum, a lot of research that LinkedIn has been doing recently as well, the skills around creativity, strategic thinking, resilience, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, you know, those are the ones to really be looking at. And also the technical skills around AI, machine learning, robotics, I would be looking at those. And for companies, I think you have to almost create the products that will going to destroy maybe the existing products that you currently offer in the market. And that can be really scary. If you're a bank, for example, I was talking with a bank the other day, and I was speaking to two banks. One is a Middle East bank, and the other one is a bank in South America. And the bank in South America is essentially saying, everything's going to be fine. We have our market. This technology stuff, it's not going to really have a big impact here in Latin America in the same way. Great, fine. Let's see how you do with that. The one in the Middle East, what they've essentially done is they've created an innovation lab within the bank. So any employee can essentially take 6 months out of their work in the bank, set up a business inside the main bank, and try things and test things. And knowing that you have, if it works, then maybe the big bank is going to take that on and going to bring that into their service. And if it doesn't work, then, you know, that's fine. You've learned lessons and you reinvent and you do something else. I would much rather, if I was an employee, I would much rather be working for that bank in the Middle East that's willing to entertain the idea of innovation and trying new things than the one in Latin America that's just kind of put their head in the sand. So I think that's also, you know, if someone watching this just now and they don't necessarily consider themselves an entrepreneur, you can be an intrapreneur with inside a business, and you can innovate with inside a business. And that's equally as valid as being an entrepreneur outside a business.
Thank you for that. Now, regarding the skill, the creativity skill, which you always mention that is going to become more and more important. What would you say to people to unlock your creative potential? What are like three key steps you should take unlock your creative potential?
Yeah, so I talk about a number of things. One is we talk about the creative process. So that's about how you generate and develop ideas. And essentially there's five steps or stages for that. One is what we call the preparation stage. So a good tip there is when you're in that preparation stage, always have a notebook if you can. Always around you where you're just making notes. We have a thing in creativity training called morning pages. Spending that first 5-10 minutes in the morning, just stream of consciousness thoughts out onto the page. Now, in my case, I've got really bad handwriting. So what I tend to do is I use my iPhone and I speak into it for 5-10 minutes, and AI transcription service transcribes what I've said and puts it into my inbox. But the main thing in that first stage is just be capturing these random thoughts and ideas as they're starting to come to you, and then you can make sense of them later on. The second stage is the incubation stage. And what I would encourage you to do, if you're doing any type of research, maybe you're thinking about launching a new product or doing a new type of event, do your research at the preparation stage, but don't try to immediately start always generating ideas. You want to something switch to another project for a little while. For example, if you're working, sitting at your computer, sitting working away, get up, stand up, move around a little bit. Only 18% of your ideas will come when you're sitting in front of a computer. So we have this, we call the incubation stage, where we have to put things to the back of our mind, let them cook there for a little while. There was a great quote from Thomas Edison, an inventor of the light bulb, who said, "Never go to bed without a request to your subconscious." And what that means is that, 2 hours before you go to sleep at night, ask yourself maybe questions. Ask yourself maybe, let's say, what is the one thing we could do to increase registrations for this next event that we're doing? What is the one thing I could do to increase my relationship with my brother or my sister? If you ask yourself that question, about those questions, about 2 hours before you go to sleep at night, overnight, your brain incubates these questions and it cooks it away. Your brain is looking for connections. And in the morning, your brain is fuzzy, it's unwound, you're open to unconventional thoughts. And often the times in the morning, you'll start generating those, maybe in the shower in the morning, those ideas will start coming to you, but you have to do the preparation and a bit of that incubation before. And then when we start generating our ideas, once again, always make sure you've got ways of capturing those ideas, those random thoughts as they're coming to you. Even what you drink and you eat can affect your levels of creativity. For example, there was a work done by Martha Farrar, who's a neurologist at the University of Pennsylvania. And she found out that high levels of coffee in your diet will reduce the number of ideas, insights that you generate. So caffeine's really good for the preparation stage when you're just absorbing information, researching. It's also fine for the last stage of the creative process. But when you're looking to go into that stage of really just looking to generate ideas, you need to be more expansive. And caffeine kind of goes against that. Caffeine's a bit about directing in. So we dial down the caffeine levels, switch to water, to tea or something. And then the fourth stage is the evaluation stage. This is where you look at all these ideas that you've been generating and you decide which ideas do you want to pursue. And I work with a lot of companies do brainstorming ideation sessions. Unfortunately, a lot of companies do brainstorming sessions not particularly well. So a common thing you'll go into is a brainstorming session, and you'll go into the brainstorming session and there's a board behind you, and there's one guy, usually it's a man, holding the one whiteboard pen in the room, and somehow it's his ideas that end up dominating the board. So we need to get rid of that stuff, because you want to get the best from every single person in the room. So I'd always encourage you to tell everyone in advance what the problem or the challenge is, that the reason that they're coming for the brainstorming in the first place. Because some people think better in advance. They like to mull it over in their head and crunch it a little bit in their head before they come into a meeting. They don't think so well spur of the moment. And then when everyone comes into the room, everyone should be given post-it notes, pens. No one should be allowed to dominate the board. If you can, have someone that almost acts as the facilitator of the brainstorming, whose job there is really to bring all these and get the best ideas out of others. And then the final thing I would say is spend the first 10 minutes of any brainstorming session that you do brainstorming the question rather than the answers and the solutions. Because often when you go into a brainstorming session, everyone's in solution mode. But if you spend the first 10 minutes asking, just really think about first principle questions. Well, why are we even launching into this market? Why are we working with this partner on this product? Why are we doing it this way? Why? If you generate lots of questions first 10 minutes, often what it will do is you'll find out the problem you were thinking you were solving is actually not the main problem. Maybe it's a different challenge or problem. And it will allow you to certainly attack the challenge in a different way. And then the final stage of the creative process is the elaboration. It's the 1% inspiration, that 99% perspiration. So this is the 99% perspiration bit. And for that, I think there's techniques like lean startup, minimum viable products that can be very useful for giving a sense of what we call psychological safety in the workplace where people feel that they're okay, it's okay to experiment, to try things, to do little tests, what we call minimum viable products. So check out works by Eric Ries, Lean Startup. That's a very good way of thinking about how you can go from an idea in your head or the ideas in people's heads, and then start to do that first test to see, is this actually something that we think could work in a larger scale? So those are just a bunch of ideas in terms of how people could be better at their creativity, how they generate and develop ideas.
Those are very useful tips. Thank you very much. Now we're going to be going into like the event side. We're going to step away from the creativity side. Then my first question is, what do you as a speaker, I mean, you've been to thousands of events probably, what do you expect at events and what can enhance your experience at such events?
I think events are going through a real change at the moment, because it used to be a lot of conferences and say association events, or they were primarily about content. So you would go there and there'd be a bunch of speakers and they would speak for their hour each or whatever. And then you might have some coffee breaks in between, and they would often be giving a speech which they'd rehearsed, and it was the same speech they'd probably given the week before. And it was all about content. But today we have things like TED Talks. We have online videos. We have YouTube. So I think the role of events now is more about community. More about experience. And I think that's where we can learn a lot from music festivals, for example, those more experiential types of things that you do. Because yes, people are going to go there. You're going to go to an event because you want to hear a particular speaker, or you want to learn something. But I think a bigger part now is we're so focused on our own lives in these little digital places that we're in. We actually want to have some communal experience. We want to have that time where we come together I love going to those events where, which give you lots of time to have those experiences. Whether that's just having a cup of tea, cup of coffee with someone, and in a chair sitting outside at something, or you some kind of networking thing, or whatever it is, just having those experiences, or even rather than the speaker just speaking up on stage to 1,000 people all the time. What about if you, that hour long speech, what about if you made it 30 minutes of speech, 30 minutes of Q&A, for example? And I think you're seeing a lot more of that now as well. And I'm personally, I really dislike panels. I don't like these ideas of four people on a panel that are just, I never find them particularly enlightening as a participant. And even as someone that speaks on them, has to ask to speak on them sometimes. I would much rather that you had smaller groupings where you put people together to discuss things that are coming out of a particular topic, for example. So I would say take the experience way up and maybe make the content pieces a little bit shorter and more bite-sized chunks.
So it's more about like the community and bringing people together than the content.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Interesting.
And I say that, and I'm probably doing myself out of a job as I say this, because I know how much as speakers we're often brought in for content. That's why you're, but I think, certainly the way I speak, TEDx is slightly different, but most conferences I'm giving, we're spending quite a significant amount of that time. I might be giving speaking for an hour, but 40 minutes of that is a speech, but 20 minutes of that is the Q&A piece where I'm working with the audience. And even during my speech, I'm working with the audience. And trying to make it as interactive as I possibly can, because I know I'm now competing against a mobile device. I'm competing against that email that you probably want to check in your inbox, or that Facebook post. That's my competition. So I have to always be thinking about that and how I can be creating levels of interaction.
Okay. And then besides from like creating Q&As or kind of not focusing on the content, but on how you want to create an experience, what other tips can you give to event organizers?
Yeah, so the other thing I get asked a lot to do now is the pre and post event. So normally what used to be like conferences, they would do maybe a pre thing would be they would send out a questionnaire, for example, or they would just send out the agenda of the event. And then the post was maybe a survey. did you enjoy it? Which speakers do you enjoy most? That was the kind of pre and post. But I think that's kind of boring. And I think it's more interesting now where, let's say, if I was speaking at an event, for example, I'm speaking in India next month, and we're doing, for one of the days before, about 3 weeks before the event, we're doing a day on Twitter with all the speakers that are speaking at it. We're just all coming together on Twitter, and we're all just talking and starting to raise the consciousness about this particular event and the topics, and asking questions and getting a feel of the people that are attending. So that's kind of pre-event content you can be creating with the speakers, asking your speakers to be those. And then when on the post side, you could do webinars, for example. That's a really good thing to do. You could even be doing it, if you're an event, you could be offering upsells. You could say, listen, we're going to, as part of this event, we're going to have an event 2 days later, which is only for 50 people instead of the 500 people. And it's going to be more like a retreat, like 1 day retreat style, where we bring most of the speakers that are speaking at the event together. It's a much more intimate type of place. We're going to do, different types of things. So you can always be thinking like, what's the pre and what's the post. Another thing you can do on the post is breaking down some of the content, and providing it to people in the days and the weeks after the event, so that they continue to implement it in their lives and in their business. So an example for that, I got one yesterday. I spoke at an event in Brazil, and the organizers are now sending out a series of almost like briefing documents after the event where, okay, here's the one thing to do this week to implement James's, what he was talking about. And then they're going to be dripping out. So these are all, different ideas about what you can do in the pre and the post.
Those are very good ideas. Thank you. So is there anything else you would like to add to that?
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that, I'm always fascinated by events. I've been involved in events. I think the first time I ever did an event, I think technically it was, I remember being asked, my father is a musician, and getting asked to take a cake on stage at a concert he was doing in California. And I took this cake on stage, and I didn't know, there was this big guy, piano player, who was, I think it was like 70th birthday or something. I took this cake on stage, and it turned out that he was Oscar Peterson, who's a great Canadian jazz pianist. And I only learned this years later. So I've kind of got events in my blood. About a year ago, I wanted to really understand as a speaker where events are going, where live events are going, and what the trends are. And so what I did is I interviewed myself and another speaker called Aaron Gargan. We interviewed 45 of the world's best event organizers, conference organizers. And if people go to eventprofessionalsummit.com, you can actually get a free pass. And you can watch all these interviews that we did together. And there was so many amazing insights I learned about events, not just that related to me as a speaker, but how do you sell more tickets to your event? How do you create more interactive experiences at your event? How do you reduce costs for your event? And I learned about all these things by doing that as well. So that's a final tip, I would give to people, just go and check out eventprofessionalsummit.com. There's a free pass there so people can register for free.
Perfect, so they can check out all the interviews on the Event Professional Summit. They will do that, perfect. So I have a few more bonus questions which are not related to the blog. But I saw that you're also into like online marketing strategies. And right now I'm working a lot with like online marketing, but I only just started. Do you have any tips for that? How do you deal with that? You also work with social media, and I see you have amazing podcasts. So do you have any advice on that?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would probably do is to spend time identifying your customer avatars, maybe those 4 or 5 ideal types of customers for your product. And then I would go really deep on those, and I would try and meet them, those different types of avatars in real life. And I would just talk to them about, where are you spending your time? What are you reading? What social media are you using? What TV shows are you watching just now? What do you do when you're not at work? And I'd be getting a really full picture. And what we do, for when we do our summits, for example, We even give them names. You know, Sue, you know, this is her. She's a 36-year-old. This is what she does. And this is her job. This is how much she makes. This is what she keeps her awake at night. This is what she's worried about in her job. This is where she wants to get to in her job. And if you can build a really full picture of that, it makes it much easier when it comes to doing the tactical pieces of marketing and online marketing, decide this is where we should be spending our time. This is where we shouldn't be wasting our time. So for example, if you know that that custom avatar, let's say your average event organizer, a planner, they live in Instagram and they live in LinkedIn, then that's the time you should be spending there. You probably shouldn't be spending so much time on Facebook. If you have another audience who are really into video, a lot of video, then YouTube needs to be a stronger play for you. So I would be looking to understand those customers first, and then just ask, find out where they hang out, finding out what other products they buy. For example, let's say if you're an event organizer, you're probably buying things like, you know, the wristbands, you know, for events. Could you partner with one of those companies that probably has a big database of people that subscribe that have bought their products, in order to give them some pieces of content, useful pieces of content to their audience? Because most companies that are involved in this business, the event business, they're always looking ways to add value. And that could be something that could be in adding value by content, like we're doing just now, really useful blog post. It could be video, it could be podcasts, it could be cheat sheets, checklists. It could be all different types of ways, you know, you could add value. And then I think that's when you have to experiment and you have to find out what your audience likes and what they don't like. So there's no particular, I wouldn't say, you know, focus on this social media as opposed to this. I would say it's not what I consider important and what you consider important. It's what where your customers live. And I would just be going really deep on them and really understanding what their pain points are and how you could help solve that, those pain points. And sometimes that relates directly to your product and other times it doesn't.
Thank you. I'll try all of those things out. Well, this was the first time that I did such an interview for my blog. So is there anything I could have done better? Is there anything you can also advice that you can give me?
For interviewing guests?
For interviewing guests.
Yeah. So this is more like a technical thing, make your life easier. You can take this interview just now, mm-hmm. and you can download get the audio from it from Zoom.
Yeah.
If you go to rev.com, just give it the audio file and it will automatically create the transcript of what we've spoken about. That will save yourself a lot of time.
Yeah.
And then you can just go and obviously then write it in your own words, but it takes a lot of the churn work. So I would use something like rev.com. There's a couple of other ones, but rev.com is pretty good. They have an automated one and they have a human one. So maybe just, I think it's the automated one's like 10 cents a minute. I think that, you know, the price of it. So this one will cost you like $4 or something, and then you can get it all transcribed.
Perfect. I'll use that. So we're at the end of the interview.
Great.
Thank you very much again for agreeing to doing this.
My pleasure.
And I'll send you an email as soon as the blog post is up. I'll tag you on LinkedIn when I do post it on social media.
That's great. And I'm just going to have a quick look. I wanted to see where we're at now with the video, the YouTube video from 10 minutes you did. Let me have a look. Creativity speech. Here we go. We've got 15,000 views now.
Yeah. You have the
them. That's great. That's good. That's good. 42 likes, 4 dislikes. That's always interesting.
4 dislikes.
Yeah. That's fine. That's fine. You need some disses. People dislike things. Otherwise, you're doing something wrong. You don't have dislikes. Yeah. Good. Good. Well, let me know when this comes out. Look, oh, and I'll be happy to share it as well.
Thank you very much.
All the best for the business. Take care.
You too.
Bye bye. Bye bye. Take care. Bye.